Test.
Okay, the next major phase of my father's career and of the family's happenings were that he started with Chrysler in the late summer of 1949, and we moved temporarily, of course, into accommodations near Birmingham, as they had found a house at that time that they were wanted to complete the building of. And by this time also, my youngest sister, Marie, had been adopted into the family. She was actually my my cousin, and unfortunately my aunt died giving childbirth to her, and my family, we adopted her. She became my my youngest sister, and she was approximately 2 years old by that time. And so in 1949, the family moved there. I, as a result of having won the Fisher Body Craftsman Skill Contest, my folks felt that they could afford to send me to a private school, and I attended as a boarding student, even though it was a short distance away, Cranbrook School in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. My folks took up residence initially in an apartment, and soon after that, in early 1950, moved into their home on Westwood Drive in Birmingham, which was my folks' permanent home for the rest of their lives. My father soon got involved in...
excuse me, Mr. Director, the actual reason for the for the move from South Bend to Birmingham?
Was that my father started with Chrysler.
But can you tell us the circumstances around his being offered the job, who offered it to him, and his acceptance?
Yes, after Ford, of course, when the offer was rejected in effect from Ford, from John Oswald, that is Roy Cole paved the way for him to see K.T. Keller and the chief engineer at that time, or vice president in charge of engineering at that time, James C. Zeter, at Chrysler, and they...
Roy Cole was a friend of Jim Zeter?
They were, yes, engineering friends, and it was determined, or had been being determined by Chrysler, that they needed to get into design in a much larger way. They had a very small styling section, headed by Henry King, and they thought this was an opportunity for them to initiate an advanced designs section. They were declining in sales considerably in 1949. Their cars were very narrow, stodgy, especially in the cheaper car lines of Plymouth and Dodge, and they determined that they needed to do something rather rapidly. And for that reason, with my father's availability, decided that they would start him as the director of an advanced styling section. And he was given the green light to go ahead and hire some people. Actually, the entire staff of design at that time numbered some 17 people, and so they were very very hurting for to keep up with the times compared to General Motors and Ford.
Exactly. I think you mentioned this before. Maybe you can elaborate on what was the reason for Chrysler lagging so far behind.
Well,
in the question of having a full design staff.
Right. They, I believe, part of the story is that K.T. Keller was prone to insisting that his cars, that their Chrysler's cars, be able to step in and out of them with a top hat, which was rather an old philosophy. It was also very much oriented to heavy engineering hand. They had some wonderful products. They were very sound products. They started at that time to get into more advanced transmissions, engine development, and chassis development, and their cars were very soundly built, very heavily built, and they were entire lines of cars were dominated by a very heavy engineering hand. Not that that's an anything wrong with that. It's just that it was rather old-fashioned engineering to a certain extent. And it had very little room for styling. Their cars, they had also had suffered, and their the engineers in particular knew that. And it was very apparent to my father at the time that they that the their daring experiment in the early 30s, in the 34 and 35, at that time, into their aerodynamic cars, the Chrysler Airflow in particular, had which were quite good cars, but left them sales wise were really let them down, and they associated those cars with having been heavily styled. They weren't in reality. They were again a result of the wind tunnel, which was an admirable stance to take at that time. But they were there was little actual style that went into them, and they were rather poorly designed from a styling standpoint. In fact, they were quite downright ugly, even though they were aerodynamic. As everybody knows, even today, we have a heavy emphasis on aerodynamics today. Every design section does. It's very interesting. It's very rewarding. But there's still a lot of room for pure style within the confines of aerodynamics.
So in fact, your father was a godsend for them.
Well,
his availability does.
Yes, his availability. He knew something about engineering. It was engineering oriented in his attitude, and they felt that it would be beneficial to start to probe a little bit further ahead. Their sales were terribly suffering, and they decided they needed to do something. So he was not made the head of all styling at that time, or they didn't even have a vice president in charge of styling at all. He was simply given the responsibility to initiate an advanced styling section. Now, the first couple of projects that he actually started to work on was with some of the designers that were already there, although they were, for the most part, they were busy finalizing plans for 1951, 52, and 53. He got into that very little as far as the production styling was concerned, but concentrated on initially a series of show car type vehicles that really resulted, the results of which were became the forward look, became the future for Chrysler styling. Those projects in particular were, well, number one, to design a parade car for the three major cities in the United States, and the car was approximately it was initiated in 1949. And it was approximately shortly after that that the car was actually built in the shops as very custom cars, large Phaetons in the Chrysler shops, fabricated there, and presented to the city of New York, one to the city of Los Angeles, I believe, and the other to Chicago. They were very impressive. They represented a new style, which was actually heavily drawn upon in the all new 1955 models. But they were my father's first really true effort there, as far as the very first effort that he did. Shortly after that, the firm of Carrozzeria Ghia in Italy had approached General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler offering custom coachwork for whatever purpose to the big three in trying to induce them to sell their coach building services. They came over in particularly Luigi Segre, who was a co-partner with Mario Buono of the firm of Carrozzeria Ghia, which had been started by Ghia himself and by the family of Ghia before that as early coach builders in the 19th century. And this changed over after the war and just prior to the war in building special coachwork bodies for some of the grand marques of Europe, in particular Italian cars, Alfa Romeo and Fiat, and as well as some French cars also. They were able to reconstruct their bombed out factory after the war and got together, Mario Buono being, and this was after Ghia himself had died in quite a tragic accident in the very late 30s. They took over the firm, Mario Buono in particular as the chief designer, and Luigi Segre as the business entrepreneur. And they came over searching for new work from America, and showing off their coach building ability, and it very much intrigued both Ford and Chrysler, because they could do such beautiful work and quite inexpensively, and they brought over a Plymouth, it was a 1950 Plymouth chassis. That they had built their own special design on. Now, during this period of time, from approximately 1946 until this time, 1949, 1950, the sports car movement, as I had mentioned before, became a very a large thing in the United States. And European car design was very much being led by the Italians. With the advent of Pininfarina and certain design work done on Fiat chassis, Alfa Romeo chassis, Ferrari was coming into the picture very strongly at that time, with some of the smaller sports cars, Cisitalia notably, the Italians were doing wonderfully clean, simple bodywork, which was a new phase for all of Europe, as opposed to the French and English at that time, who were still more or less still back in a pre-war type of styling. The Italians were rapidly making advances in the clean, simple, full-bodied cars, and the Italian design in particular was fresh looking, clean, aggressive, smooth, aerodynamic, and it was very impressive to the American design styling sections at the time.
Did this appeal to your father?
Very much so. He very much believed in the purity and the honesty that they showed, and he took this up and didn't merely apply it to his efforts and to his direction, because the European car, especially the popular European car at that time, or cars, were much smaller, of course, than their American counterparts, and so that tremendous simplicity that they had about them couldn't be directly applied to a much larger car. One notable, flop at that time was when Nash actually hired Pininfarina to design one of their larger cars, and While his efforts had been excellent on some of the smaller European cars, very large, plain, bathtub that it resulted in was clearly something he found a little difficult to handle.
Was that the 1950, was it?
Yeah, that was approximately, I believe, 1949, 1950.
It wasn't called the airplane, was it?
No, it was the Nash, it was a Nash Ambassador, I believe, that was done by Pininfarina.
And that flopped, though?
It was quite a flop, yes. The American public, of course, was not on to European design by a long shot. Designers, naturally, are aware of those trends throughout the world, but of course the public had not been given
condition
to it or used to that. So, so there was still it would be quite a long time really before they got.
Did Segre approach your father?
Segre approached basically through Mr. C.B. Thomas, who was the European vice president of Chrysler, in charge of export division. More or less, I approached through C.B. Thomas and to engineering, to Jim Zeter, who was the vice president in charge of engineering, and to show what they called the Plymouth XX500 or 500X, and it was shown to my father, and he thought that was their workmanship was wonderful, and the prices were just unbelievable for compared to these parade cars, which had been
very
built.
Expensive.
Had been built by Chrysler shops themselves at an enormous cost, $300,000, something like that. At that time, that was a tremendous amount of money. Well, Ghia was showing this little Plymouth, and it wasn't nearly as big, but it was a totally new body built on a more or less standard chassis. But they were quoting prices for show cars to be built for from $10,000 to $20,000 at that time, and so. And the workmanship was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bit of a fear on the part of Chrysler that, they would be taking work away from union shops at that time to have these cars built in Italy. But nevertheless, they signed a contract with Segre to go ahead and build a design. Chrysler would design the car. And Ghia would build it, the first in what became the first true show car that my father was responsible for with the new design section at Chrysler. Meanwhile, he hired, he built up his design section there, got it up to maybe 30 people, but that included shop personnel, of course, administrative personnel. But he hired some important people, the likes of Cliff Voss, who had been with Kaiser Fraser, and also Maury Baldwin, a Canadian designer, Maury Baldwin.
M-A-U-R-I,
Maury.
Oh, M-A-U-R-I.
Yeah, right, Baldwin, who had been quite a top-notch illustrator for one of the ad companies here in Detroit, and who was himself a designer. Ted Peach, I'm not exactly sure where Ted had come from. And then shortly after that, several people, including modeling personnel especially, that had come to Chrysler and knew that my father was starting something new there. Many people flocked from General Motors and Ford at all times to try to secure work there, and he was able to start to build up a design section.
Hire the best of
and hire some very, very good people. Thus was born the start of the famous show cars that really turned Chrysler styling around in the early 50s, And the first of these cars to be built was the Chrysler K310.
This was Are you segueing from Ghia to Chrysler? I mean, is this will these show cars be fabricated under the new arrangement with Segway?
Yes. The first one, good. Yes. Yeah. And the first two, really.
Okay.
The first.
So this is the first of the Ghia.
This is first of the Chrysler Ghia show cars, yes, which was the K310, Chrysler right. K310. Mm-hmm. It was built on a standard at that time a New Yorker chassis. It was a rather large car, a two-door sport coupe, but five passenger, it was totally modeled in 3/8 scale in the studios at Chrysler in Highland Park, and it was that the plaster model of it was made and shipped to Ghia.
No,
3/8 scale, quite large scale. 3/8 scale was modeled in clay, cast in plaster, and shipped to Ghia.
Shipped by air, by boat.
They shipped at that time by air. The models later on, it was air shipment, but it was pretty much by ship. At any rate, this was the this represented kind of a neoclassic design. It still had a rather handsome radiator. Grill approach with headlights set in scoops, and it had what we called at the time sort of blister-like fenders that were high at that time, and the hood was relatively low at that time. It featured a rear quarter panel that blended smoothly into the body sides, and it was quite nicely sculptured overall. And featured for the rear end as my father started to lift the rear fenders to accent that his quite famous, what became famous, gun sight taillights that were designed and actually patented at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it featured one of his favorite sports car touches at that time, which was a spare tire cover on the rear deck. And the car was quite smooth looking, very handsome. It featured very large round wheel openings and very large wire wheels, as he was always a fan of that classic type of approach. Now, as opposed to a lot of other show cars at that time, it was looked upon as being very honest, very clean, very automobile in its concept, as opposed to some of the Buck Rogers, what we called the Buck Rogers type of styling that was for future cars that was being shown at that time by General Motors and Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And it met with extremely good success as far as the public was concerned, and especially the people that thought that Chrysler were virtually on their demise with not getting with it as far as that's concerned, and with the world community as far as design is concerned, because it represented to something that was hitherto the cars that they saw the future going to weren't quite as honest and clean and sculptural as this whole idea represented. Part of its large success was also due to the fact that Chrysler was everybody was getting into V8 engines at that time. Most notably, the Olds 88 engine had started the V8 overhead valve revolution in 1947, Chrysler was a little bit lagging behind from that standpoint. But their emphasis was on developing the famous hemispherical V8, which was a very important part of the contribution that Jim Zeter made, really, to the industry, that was his pride and joy. And of course, K.T. Keller was as the president of Chrysler, backed this car up completely, and gave my father the green light and a free hand without interference as far as the body design is concerned. And it featured, of course, this very powerful new V8 engine that Chrysler was to further develop into production. And the combination was really quite sensational. And thus the car was called the K310, 310 meaning the flash horsepower that they got out of at that time. K standing for Keller's involvement in it. And it
KT was his initials, wasn't it?
KT was his initials, yes.
Stands for Tuma. Tuma is his.
I believe so, yes.
Is it Kellner or something? No, couldn't be.
Kellner, bodybuilder.
Yeah, right.
But at any rate, this was followed, this was approximately 1951. The very next car that came was nothing more than a convertible version of it, because the car was successful. Sagri was given the contract to do the second version, which was just a convertible version called the Chrysler C200. Those were the first two cars. Well, in the summer of 1951 itself, my father always was drawing at home throughout his whole career, either drawing, painting, or doing something, always at home. He got more chance to be unbothered by managerial responsibilities and by the everyday work, and he could concentrate. He always felt on his own and had a chance to really truly do something on his own. It's very difficult to do that when you're in a managerial position, to actually be able to be drawing on the boards as well as supervising the work of modelers, designers, and administrative people within your own areas.
Did he have an administrator?
Initially, just a secretary, but then later on, of course, he had several full-time administrators
who would take care of the personnel
people, and yes, as well as he delegated the work, was able to delegate the work.
That he had that opportunity
to
get away from the dreary routine of...
Well, it was still not dreary, but it was something that it took time, and he was interested in the welfare of the people and building up the design section, and working with engineering people, of course, there was always always a little battle going on there between the engineering fraternity and. He had the support always of the sales department and advertising people, Keller had more or less made it clear to people that this is the way things were going to be, and also at that time K.T. Keller had brought in Tex Colbert from basically a sales background. Into the company. He became the president, and then
L.L. Colbert.
L.L. Colbert. Lester Lum Colbert.
He came from sales,
huh? Basically, he came from sales, what would you call it, management area today.
Marketing
background for the most part, yes, a marketing sales background.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful.
In Chrysler or elsewhere?
He had come up through Chrysler, through dealer organizations, from sales organizations in the Southwest, having been from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And thus was born the Texan X show to a great extent, because Colbert believed that they needed to do these things and get ahead. And
Mr. Keller had been elevated to the chairman.
Yes, Keller then was elevated to a chairman, and Jim Zeter was to a vice president. And at any rate, during that summer of 1951, working in his own at home, he developed a series of three or four drawings that actually became the next series of Chrysler show cars. And two out of the three cars that he did, as well as to model a quarter-scale model in the basement at home, and those became the two out of the next three show. Really, actually, three out of the next three show cars, and they were the. Chrysler Special, and 1952 Chrysler show car, the DeSoto Adventurer in 1953, which was he always thought and was one of his nicest designs, than the Chrysler Delegance, approximately 1954. GIA themselves also did some cars on their own. They had the go ahead to do that, and some of these cars were at the especially the Chrysler Special at the instigation of C.B. Thomas, the export manager for Chrysler, actually became a small series of Chrysler-built show cars. There were about 25 or 26 of them built for very wealthy customers at that time. But these cars were primarily used to tour the country, of course, at auto shows and to tour dealerships and to drum up a lot of enthusiasm for what would be the future trend of Chrysler's. Meanwhile, my father was starting to get into just a little bit of facelift work on the 1951-52 bodies, which were quite staid, quite behind times, and there was very little he could do in the way of changing what had already gone before, what was already in place there, without a major major retooling program. And nevertheless, their sales did perk up. They did improve the engineering from the standpoint of offering the new V8s and whatnot. They became very hot stock racing cars, and their sales were starting to pick back up. But they still needed a great deal of help as far as production cars were concerned. Which my father had the opportunity to get involved with in the 1955 line. Now, he concentrated a great deal on the show cars, and there were many other variations of show cars built in 53, 54, 55. Some of them were designed by GIA, like the Fire Arrow and the Plymouth Explorer and certain. Certain cars like those. That
someone just acquired the Fire Arrow. Did you know that?
Yes, I believe I heard that.
Yeah, still in existence.
Right. Oh yeah, there are several of them in existence. The Fire Arrow, or actually it was the Fire Arrow Roadster,
yeah.
Became the prototype for a series of cars that were promoted here in Detroit and built by GIA, about 400 of which were built, that became the famous Dual GIA. Which was sold to a lot of the movie stars and people like that, and carried on and later on as the Dual GIA 2. Now, my father actually didn't design that car. It was a GIA design, basically a Boano design. He was still there until at that time, until Segre bought out Boano and took over all of GIA himself. But the designs of those cars were actually instigated more by GIA themselves and by Mario Boano. But in 1952-53, approximately during that time, when Chrysler was redesigning for 1955, at one time my father was asked to give an opinion. Again, he was really still just advanced design section, just advanced styling.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry King was responsible for carrying on with more or less production styling. But my father was asked to give an assessment of what he saw in the what were to be the 55 models, and this was approximately 18, 20 months before production.
Mm-hmm.
Which was you could get things out faster in those days, at that time he was asked to give an assessment of what he thought of those cars that were being designed at that time, and frankly told Keller that he thought they just were lousy and they'd be a flop. So Mr. Keller says, okay, you've got 18 months to redesign them completely. And those were the cars that borrowed heavily from those, getting back to those parade cars that became the 1955 car line. And they were, and it was initially started with the Chrysler New Yorker, and designed straight up from the Plymouth through the Chrysler, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, and Chrysler at that time. And they were very successful, and they really put Chrysler back in the black solidly. They had sunken to as low as approximately 13% of the market about 1950, and by 1955, and they went up to something like 19%, and went on up to approximately 22 or 23% by that time, and were phenomenally successful. Ate solidly into Ford at that time, more than General Motors, of course. The next phase then was, in effect, that of his career is he continued to develop more show cars, idea cars, always a philosophy that these cars represented was that they weren't just pretty mock-ups, not wild blue sky design. They were really looked upon as being heavily borrowed for the future, that they represented designs that could be lunched off of for production design. And
is that a designer term, lunched off of?
Yeah, right, you might say. Right. But
a variation on cannibalism.
Right, but they could they were developed to be advanced designs, sure, but not so ridiculously wild as some people did, so that they were totally useless as far as being a trendsetter, a genuine trendsetter to be baked into production cars. Mm-hmm. And thus they were running cars. Nearly every one of them were a total running prototype, and of course Guilla made that possible by their wonderful engineering themselves, that they were able to take production chassis for the most part and reskin them and do a total job of engineering into a very very excellent running show cars. And so some of the cars that took place then in 1955, 56 of the show cars that represented my father's direct involvement, and then of course as he got a larger design staff, delegated a lot of these cars, but always had his own projects going in the back room that were to influence the design of the production cars as well as the show cars. These cars, such as the Falcon in 1955, in 1956 the Flight Sweep, Flight Sweeps 1 and 2. These were the cars that were to be the predecessors of the famous forward look of 1957 and 1960, the forward look cars, in which he started to get more sculptural activity into the body design. Also started to get into the fin age very large fins also.
Were you ever able to talk to him, this is just a quick aside, in later years, how the fins came about?
Well, that's something that I lived with myself. We saw how that all came about. That's very simple. Even before the war, there were fins appearing on Le Mans road racing cars, largely on the part of German developments, right immediately after the war, the 1946-47 Cicitalias, which were actually designed by Giovanni Savinuzzi, who later on became one of the engineers for Guilla. Tremendously influenced Detroit designers, even had an influence on the 1949 Cadillac, little bump type fins, you might say, or taillight type fins on the 49 Cadillac.
That was a
definite influence on the part of the Cicitalia, of the Italian Cicitalia. Yeah. GM designers recognized these cars at that time too, and that car had a great deal of influence on Detroit overall. So My father was also influenced. He liked the cleanliness of the idea. He liked the aerodynamics of the idea. And in his mind, they were genuinely aerodynamic. And later on, Chrysler proved that. They made wind tunnel tests and ran crosswind tests with these cars that proved that they were working. And that was the intention. He didn't want to be dishonest. He didn't use them for a styling gimmick. But he did use them for a design philosophy purpose as well as a true functional purpose. Mm-hmm. And that philosophy went something like this in his mind. Cars in the 40s and early 50s were getting to have a heavy appearance. He felt that cars should look light. Even large cars should have a light appearance, a fleet appearance, a racy appearance. They should look like they're moving because they are, in effect, moving sculpture. They do move. They should look like they move. Anything that he could do sculpturally within the bodywork to give this light appearance and to lift the rear end of the car, to attract the eye to the rear end of the car in a lifted motion would help the dart-like appearance that he favored, as opposed to what we called a drag-ass look, especially with skirted rear fenders that some of the competitors exhibited at that time, notably Ford and Mercury. Had a very heavy look to them, and he wanted to get away from what he called slab-sidedness. He wanted more genuine cross-sectional sculpture to the bodies. Again, all for the purpose of making the car look overall lighter and faster and more dynamic. And thus, the natural thing to do was to go towards more of the wedge look and more of the dart look of the car. He embraced the idea of the fin completely, and of course other people were too at that time. He tried to do his in a more clean way, I believe, which was more of the way that the Cisatella had been done, very simple and very clean. They became huge, of course, because the cars were huge at that time, especially Chryslers and DeSotos, later on the Imperial. Nevertheless, that was the basic idea. And that was the general philosophy. There were some notable show cars that came along that were done by Ghia at that time that was promoted. Again, they had a wonderful designer-engineer combination in Giovanni Savinuzzi that actually worked in-house for Segre at Ghia. And later on, my father actually brought him to the United States and as a design engineer working directly for Chrysler. Giovanni Savinuzzi. He had a wonderful career. This man had actually designed the Moto Guzzi V8 motorcycle engine and had actually had an enormous amount to do with the Fiat Italian racing seaplanes for the Schneider Cup series of racing planes. He was a fully qualified aerodynamicist, having worked a great deal with Fiat and the wind tunnel and their wind tunnel and aerodynamic testing of cars, especially before the war.
Did Chrysler have wind tunnel facilities at this point?
No, they didn't. They did not have their own at that point.
So they rented them from the
universities? Yeah, University of Michigan and some of the other people that had them at that time. At any rate, that was the big success story overall, of course, was then the 1956, 57 models came out in 56, the forward look, I really don't know.
I'm sure.
And of course, the concentration on the design as he built up his staff, and it became a staff of approximately 300 people, and it's about that size today, I believe, maybe a little bit less today.
But his personal administrative staff were maybe half a dozen people.
Yes, something like that. They were headed by various publicity people, and of which he gained an enormous amount of publicity, won many awards for styling all the way from the early days. Contributed, he still very much contributed to the SAE, which he was a vice chairman of body activities for a couple of years during that period of time, and made many speeches regarding automobile design.
Have they been collected?
Yes, I have. I have, of course, they're in archives. I mean, they're in patent. They're in. Yeah, the copies of these speeches are undoubtedly collected by the SAE themselves, and he did become vice president of SAE at one time during this period of time. He was still looked upon by the engineering fraternity as one of their favorite people as far as stylists are concerned, I'm sure. During this period of time, of course, he built the design section up, having been given more control. He was named director of styling in its entirety in approximately 1955 or 56. They still had no vice president in charge of styling until 1957. He was made a vice president and became a member of the board of directors of Chrysler, of which there were very few at that time. He was made an executive vice president and director of styling. He had by this time totally reorganized design, built up quite a line staff management team. It was headed by designers and managerial people. There were, of course, a design head for each of the major divisions, Chrysler, DeSoto, and Dodge, and
each had their own studios.
Some of these people were Bill Brownlee and Johnny Schwartz, Cliff Voss.
As Schwartz?
S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z, or
good.
I believe, R-S-W-A-R-T-Z. Cliff Voss and Maury Baldwin, some of them were headed advanced design. He always had, even during this period of time, he always had his own private back room where he employed a modeler just working for him himself to rough out what he thought were new hot ideas that he wanted to keep his hand in. Didn't have too much time at home. Was starting to do a lot of traveling because as early as 1950 he had gone to Italy to consult with Ghia, with Segre there, was fascinated and loved Europe and became a very close friend of Luigi Segre besides, liked to travel throughout Europe. My mother started to go with him, and they enjoyed particularly Paris, and he enjoyed particularly the left bank and haunting through various bookshops and art galleries and in both Italy and France, and finally was able to pursue historical art interests. During this time, the pressures of work also build up, where he'd become quite an important designer and had a very large responsibility. This weighed on his health, of which he had never been particularly careful of. By this time, even by the time he started with Chrysler, his hair had turned completely silver from very dark. And this was, he was only, at the time he started with Chrysler, he was only 40 years old. But he was completely silver, completely white by that time. Very handsome personage, was looked upon that way in the industry. Very dapper dresser and very sharp, and still had rather unpolitical approach to his business dealings overall. And the family was looked upon, regarded, I always felt, quite highly by fellow competitors, for that matter. But it nevertheless took quite a toll on, as it does, that type of position, and resulted in heart trouble. He was a heavy chain smoker, drank an awful lot of coffee, stayed up pretty late, and did a little bit of drinking, not terribly. It was affected to him, but he wasn't a constant drinker of any kind. But it was a lot of pressure, and he was doing some battle with various factions of marketing and or not marketing, but manufacturing and engineering community to fight to get his designs at all times across and executed properly.
In these years, he had the confidence of K.T. Keller.
Well, yeah, but KT by this time had more or less was up.
Yeah,
it was not directly in the picture. It was Tex Colbert that was his very large sponsor at this time.
Good.
He the president of the company was very supportive. They became good friends, and he was very supportive. And Jim Zeter was fine too, for that matter.
Jim Charlie Donovan here in the mid-50s.
Yes, and then Harry Chesborough, as far as the body designer, they were initially, my father and Harry were bitter enemies, but became very good friends, and finally both of them saw eye to eye, and it was some of the people that got on his nerves that were starting to get into it, like some of the penny pinchers the accounting aspects of things, and the manufacturing was starting to get to it, because because some of these cars were getting pretty elaborate and whatnot. They were harder to build now than some of the earlier, simpler type of stuff. And so manufacturing was, and they were expanding greatly. Their business was going great at that time, and especially up until 57, 58, and they were able to expand sales tremendously. But the quality was getting to them a little bit, not necessarily as a result of design, but as a result of greater production, perhaps, and it also as a result of the general tone of quality that was happening within the industry overall. However, in the scramble to get new models out and give them quite extensive facelifts during that period of time in the mid to late 50s, things were a bit under-engineered, and perhaps the manufacturing element of it was not given the time or attention for testing that would result in a better lasting quality overall. In other words, styling was kind of getting ahead of the whole works to a certain extent, and later on, and that was corrected. But it was a phase that was a pretty bizarre phase in the history of automobile styling design. In that it was extremely competitive with General Motors and Ford, especially, and Chrysler had a bit of the best of it. Naturally, I would feel that way at the time, but I think that's regarded quite true overall. They managed to get at least on an even par with their two larger competitors. So. This took quite a toll on my father. He started to have heart trouble, resulting in a quite a massive heart attack in 1956. And as a matter of fact, he was very close. And as a matter of fact, when he pulled through it, open heart surgery and whatnot, he wound up in the hospital, of course. And more or less came around to the fact that one of his great show cars had just been lost on the Andrea Doria while he was lying in the hospital bed.
That's incredible. Could you give us a little bit of background on that? That's always been this kind of a murky episode.
Well, not so. It's,
I don't mean
the car was. The car was called the Norseman. It was one of the. It was.
What was it to be? A really advanced fastback design.
It was very clean. Of course, it had quite a large fin-like designs, but it was a very much of a sculptured fastback. Very clean front end. Had retractable headlights, and the most unique feature about it was that. The entire roof was cantilevered out of this fastback design from the rear, and it was held in place what would normally be the A-pillar with a wraparound windshield. It was held in place in the front by very thin steel rods that actually tied the front of the roof down to the cowl structure. And the windshield then was in between, of course, very clean wraparound. It resulted in basically no vision obstruction for the entire windshield all the way around to the side glass. And
how radical was this at this point?
And it was very radical. And of course, just immediately preceding this with the 55, 56 models, a couple of my father's very strong design, not innovations. He didn't actually innovate them, but a couple of the things that he really truly promoted for the industry was curved side glass in cars, and of course thin pillars, and also he liked the idea of the wraparound windshield, but he didn't he still wanted to have his A pillar slanted forward. However, this particular show car design was the A-pillar wrapped, or the windshield wrapped around completely with just these very thin steel rod connecting the roof to the cowl. The object behind this was safety to a great extent also, not from only from a vision standpoint, but from the fact that in a rollover situation, it was thought that the rods would shear and the roof would actually spring giving a crush-proof a situation to the occupants. It was a large car built on a Chrysler chassis, and it was finished just about June of 1956, and it was shipped to Detroit on the Andrea Doria. This was the large Italian ocean liner. A few other cars.
Had you been using the Andrea Doria?
They've been using various shipping, mostly Italian, because it was their, the cars came from Genoa or from Rome, and they were shipped out of Genoa for the most part. Mm-hmm. It was not crated. Most of them were just tied down in the holes. And,
was that the normal procedure in those days?
Yes, for the most part, yes. And so it, unfortunately, the ship went down in a very famous collision at sea. And
nighttime or fog collision?
It was early early morning. Oh, it was at nighttime, yes, early morning.
And actually, another ship ran into that.
Yes, it was the... Holland American Line Dutch ship or
Swedish.
Or it was Swedish, I believe. That's all quite well documented.
Yeah, right.
Photographs have come back from divers have taken pictures of the car in the ship since that time. Very dim, murky photographs.
It's still there.
It's still there. Yeah,
but too far down. Too.
It's not enormously, not nearly as far as the Titanic, but it's in about, 300 feet of water, something like that, and it's just a little bit
did
too far
down.
Did
your father ever entertain the notion of trying to retrieve it?
Oh, no. I mean, he couldn't. He he loved the idea that maybe somebody would someday,
because
he was always, again, the romanticist in him, loved tales of shipwrecks and as I probably mentioned before, tales of the Old West and steam locomotives and all that type of all adventure stories and King Arthur and castles and adventure type stories overall. So that was fascinating to him. He got a kick out of that, as a matter of fact. He thought, oh, that's neat. One of my cars went down in a big famous shipwreck, you know.
I guess what I've never been able to understand is why it wasn't duplicated.
Well, it had to get on to new things. I mean, there wasn't, it was kind of a waste of time to really go back and rebuild it in any way, even though there were still, probably there was some mannequins left and hammer forms and things like that that probably wouldn't have taken too much, and I guess Chrysler collected on the insurance, of course, but I think it was thought, you know, by the time you design anything, it's obsolete. And I think that even my father probably thought that, well, rather than have it duplicated, let's take that money and do the latest, newest thing that's is in his mind. Again, I want to reiterate that while in some cases these show cars were actually drawn and designed by my father's own hand and actually modeled in some cases, especially the DeSoto Adventure and the Chrysler SS and the Delegance to a great extent, for the most part, any design effort whether they be show cars or production designs is a team effort, and he had lots of talented people surrounding him, engineers as well as designers and modelers that of course contributed to the specific areas of any vehicle, be it the body side design or the front end, rear end, or the entire vehicle. And in the case of many of these cars, it became impossible for him to completely design, and it wouldn't be right anyway for him to dictate the design, although he held a pretty tight rein on an overall picture of what he wanted to accomplish and the direction for design to go. He nevertheless delegated a responsibility to people to come up with their ideas and to promote their designs within the framework of the overall philosophy. They went about this quite enthusiastically, and he gave them a lot of credit for that, although he was given, of course, the overall credit on the part of design awards and things like that. Nevertheless,
so it wasn't nevertheless,
pardon?
Nevertheless, what I stepped on the line. But nevertheless, he did have many talented designers.
Yes, many, many talented designers, of course, of whom the majority, I think, enjoyed working with him and respected him overall.
But it occurs to me that this is such a marvelously radical engineering design that it's really so those principles.
That particular car. It was quite radical, but again, they themselves wanted to get on too, and I'm sure with new things too.
It's a shame that those principles that the cantilever wrote,
yes, that's true,
and the were not available.
They were kind of abandoned, almost, you might say,
have they
a
ever
bit
been utilized
with that. Not to my knowledge. One of the closest thing that I've ever seen was actually preceded it, which was back in the 30s. There was a Delahaye, or I can't remember right now. I know exactly what it looks like. Large central fin on the rear of the car, very shapely body,
and
it was a Talbot or a. Or a Delahaye that was, or a Talbot, I believe it was a Talbot, yes. With a wraparound
fin.
Windshield, with a dorsal fin, and again with this principle of a cantilevered fastback roof, and that's a quite good-looking, handsome car. I think it exists today as a collector's car, as a matter of fact.
So sad that that wasn't resurrected. That,
yeah.
That the Norseman disappeared. Disappeared with it. Yeah.
Right. It did.
But on to other things, obviously.
Well, then
the
of course.
The market and the.
Well, then of course, as I mentioned, he was in the hospital when this happened.
Oh,
and,
no.
And nearly didn't survive himself, but he was. Nearly written off by the corporation, and as a matter of fact, during that time, they didn't know whether he was going to make it back and be able to fully recover from the situation, and thus Tex Colbert brought in Bill Schmidt at that time to more or less take over. My father had not made any strong plans for any one of his own people to more or less take his place, and it was felt that it was perhaps better to have someone come in from the outside
as an interim
to handle it as on an interim basis.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so they brought in Bill Schmidt, and then my father did make a slow recovery and came back in Schmidt was there for about 2 years, and he did cause my father some political problems. But in a couple of years, they managed to let him go,
mm-hmm.
and my father was back in total command again. But there was some disruptions, and
the problem was Schmidt. He obviously wanted to stay on. Huh?
Well, sure, of course, and he took some people back with him when he went to Studebaker Packard,
mm-hmm.
And some of the he alienated naturally with
sure.
promises. Stick with me, and we'll
sure.
Politically, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
Some of the people that my father had entrusted.
Right.
But nevertheless, my father came back and was made at that time. That's approximately at the time that he was made a corporation vice president and director of Stone. 1957 then. And during his recovery period from 1956 from mid-1956 to 1957, he was able to relax a great deal at home initially, and retook up his artistic career on painting, especially watercolor painting, some charcoal sketches, and forgot about cars for a while. Although he still had some, didn't really forget about it at all. He had some daily contacts with Tex Colbert, and was kept appraised by his real design cohorts what was going on during the period of time that he actually was physically away from Chrysler, which was approximately three months. And and during that period of time he was starting to get back in doing the things that he really genuinely loved best, which was drawing and painting and especially some large transparent watercolors that he did during that period of time, and reintroduced himself to the fine arts end of the business, and with a great deal of having more time to be able to pursue that that endeavor that he liked so much. He had some time to finally pursue a bit more of his artistic end. There's quite a bit of repetitiveness
That's
in there,
right.
but you know. And he was away from the day-to-day work then from Chrysler for a period of 3 or 4 months. During this time, he was being given credited with rave reviews the 1957 Chrysler line, which he had just completed before this misfortune took place.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, they were very much hard at work on the on the 1960s line of cars, especially for the facelift versions 58, 59, and then the another all-new line of cars for 1960. After he returned full-time to Chrysler, they went through some economic periods of bad time there, as the whole industry did in 1958-59, but GM hit very hard with their 1959-1960 all new lines of cars, and the next plan of really totally redesigned cars at that time that was planned by my father, as far as design was concerned, was what he, up until this time and through 1960, he had more or less promoted the short hood and long deck, lots of glass greenhouse, and the large fins type of designs for Chrysler. He was largely responsible for that whole philosophy. He had been playing with in the late 50s, in 1958-59, he had been playing with the idea of getting back to a little bit more of a classical theme, a little bit more automotive theme, not such a totally full complete body sides and full fenders, but to get back to a little bit more, even more sculpture, and more important, to a long hood and short deck type of overall car proportion. And he was developing some of these ideas in his own back room of his second office, which was kind of a hidden away office at Chrysler at that time, and was really really promoting the production design of that type of style. And so his next...
How did it differ from the previous?
Well, from the proportion standpoint, okay, is that everyone had picked up at that time, everyone, the whole industry had picked up the idea of the low, wide hoods that were quite short, and with the rather very long decks with the big fins and everything. They all picked that up. This was really more back to a more classic proportion of the long hood and the short deck, something which Ford themselves, of course, picked up in 1965 with the 64-65 with the Mustang, and he was starting to really promote that. He always liked long hooded cars, and he was starting to promote that, and so he was working on a series of cars for, especially for 1962, that really promoted that type of philosophy, and they were built a complete line of cars to show to Chrysler for their approval, based on that philosophy, and they were there were some rather radical ideas in the sculpture of them and in the proportions, of course. And however, during that time, Chrysler was running into financial sales problems. They went through some a bit of scandal type of things with Bill Newberg and
Cole had
that
type of thing. Colbert had been forced out at this point.
Yeah, Colbert was kind of being forced out. Newberg
exiled to Canada.
Well, sort of exiled to Canada. Newberg took over and made all kinds of promises.
Had there been a palace revolution? What happened?
Well, sort of. It was the coming in of the bean counter, you might say, overall. Okay, and so it was the advent of getting a closer scrutiny on costs and watching investments more closely, and that whole idea was
kind of mentality was beginning.
Yeah, it was creeping into the you know, it was kind of a lavish times back in those times,
yeah.
and and spending was you know, a lot freer, and things were getting a little tough. They've been through a couple little recessions, like
right.
I said,
1958-59, mm-hmm.
and where there were some big large layoffs. My father had to do that within his own styling sections, very much so.
Yeah.
There were people, directors that were objecting to the low return on investment. Okay.
Was one of this, one of them Ed Love? Was he one of the?
Henry Love?
No, not Henry.
No, I was designer.
L-O-V-E.
Yes.
Was there an outside designer or an outside director who became very powerful in this period? A man named Love.
Henry Love.
No, he's
the designer.
He's
okay,
designer,
this is
yeah.
Love.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
He was an outside director.
Yes.
I believe he's engineering this thing with
Newberg
and Colbert
and then Townsend coming to the Linden.
But in the meantime, your father's trying to design cars, and
that's right.
Distracted by all this.
Yes, to a great extent. Yeah. But their sales were not going well and whatnot,
uh-huh.
and so that and he had designed this whole line of cars and thought that they would really do well,
mm-hmm.
For 62, and suddenly the new corporate philosophy,
yeah.
More or less shot it down completely. This
mm-hmm.
whole line of cars that
mm-hmm.
he had prepared, really paired the expenditures, paired the cost out of them, to an extent where they were, they came out looking quite what my father always referred to as picked chickens, for the 1962 line.
Uh-huh.
They lacked the verve, they lacked they were basically there. They basically had the philosophy was there with the long hood and short deck philosophy. The philosophy wasn't objected to. There was no problem there. It was the idea on the part of management. It was just the part that they really skimped on spending on money on the to really make the design totally effective, which
right.
it needed to be. Especially for an Allman idea like that, they needed to be totally detailed so that it would totally promote that image. So they came out with that line of cars, and that line of cars was preceded by, again, some of the show cars that were being done at that time.
Forgive me, the chronology here is that your father is still vice president for design,
mm-hmm.
but there has been some tampering with, has been some skinning, in other words, of mm-hmm. some of his,
of
the 62 line.
Yes, of the 62 line in particular. Of course,
yeah.
prior to that, though, of course, the other big milestone that the industry went through was the development of the compact car. At that time, advent, the popularity that had built up in European cars, notably the Volkswagen, by that time, had resulted in financial recessionary type times, had resulted in the big three. And Studebaker, the little four by that time, that's all
right.
that was left.
Mm-hmm.
Designing and bringing out finally in production a small car for America were the compacts. Studebaker led off actually first by bringing out the Studebaker Lark, which was a shortened up version of a Studebaker Champion. I myself was in the design business by that time and actually contributed to that program.
Did you?
Officially, professionally.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, GM came out with the Corvair and Ford with the Falcon and Chrysler with the Valiant.
Mm-hmm.
They were the first compact cars in over 30 years, really, for the entire industry. And so, and my father had his ideas about that, and that was part, a little bit part of this long hood and short neck philosophy that that he carried even from there on into the 62 line. That
how did that come about in terms of your father's
involvement?
Was he very he understood that the there had to be a
welcomed the idea because he was a champion of the Studebaker champion himself years ago, and he always welcomed honesty, simplicity, and looked upon the car primarily. Even though he was romantically attached to it, loved cars and liked the adventure aspect about them. He truly believed that first of all, car was there to get a person from point A to point B, and he even thought himself at times. I know that that things were getting out of hand as far as the largeness of Detroit cars in the late 50s were just huge from an overall length standpoint, the greatest they'd ever been in history, and ponderous, and even though engineering was managing to stay up with the as large as they were, as heavy as they were, there were some wonderful engineering innovations that went on at that time that have been refined today, and we haven't made perhaps any larger strides today in terms of basic, real basic mechanical innovations since that time. From the perfection of the automatic transmission, power steering, car brakes, body structure, overall suspension and handling vastly improved in the mid to late 50s, at an astounding turnaround from the basic car that we had seen in the 40s, with few exceptions, has not been equaled even today. And then along comes the compact car for America, and became the advent of what we would say today is the small car. I think it was the 50s accomplished the mid to late 50s, early 60s accomplished a great deal in the history of the automobile. So, and during this period, one of my father's innovations, or not innovations, one of his own actual sports car designs that he was, and he always tried to push a sports car at Chrysler. They never really did bring out in production their own sports car. He just loved sports cars and racing cars, of course. But he did through the series of show cars. They brought out a car that was called and named after my father, called the Plymouth XNR. It was really a that was approximately 1959, and it was based on the Valiant chassis, and kind of promoted the Valiant type styling. Now, I'd like to say here that during the when my father got into the development of the compact car, which became the Valiant, initially. Even when I saw the development of the when my father showed me the development of the actual model itself, its very earliest phases of the Valiant full-size clay had the name Falcon on it, and that of course was because Chrysler had trademarked, registered the name Falcon themselves, because they had brought out the Falcon show car in 1959. My father liked dramatic birds. Falcon was neat, so he named the 1955 show
with
car
the
Falcon. He was always interested in heraldry and things like that. So the Falcon became a Chrysler a name. Well, in 1959, when the 1958, 57, 58, when all the companies were designing their compact cars, Ford had a history of having a name of birds for their products.
Mm-hmm.
And they very much wanted, they were developing the what became the Ford Falcon, their own small car. They were developing a car that initially started life as called a Cardinal in England, but became finally became the basis of the Ford Falcon. And Henry Ford very much wanted that that name, and went to Tex Colbert, who was still at that time the head of Chrysler president, and asked if they couldn't have the Falcon name. And it was these were kind of things that are still done today, and mm-hmm. people consort with each other without having any big corporate fights or anything like that. And so they condescended to that they agreed that they would go ahead and give him the name. But I remember Tex came to my father and asked my father's opinion about that. Should we give him the name, or how bad do you want that name, X, to put on our compact car? And he said, well, I said, I guess, you know, they do us some favors once in a while, we do them some favors, and so that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, now you got to rename the car. And so back in those days, it was well, between marketing or advertising and design, they kind of came up with the names of cars. And and so he always liked Prince Valiant, the comic strip. One of his favorite comic strips was Prince Valiant.
Oh, I do too.
And because of because of how well the, the guy could draw.
And
Al Foster,
Al Foster,
that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And just always loved Prince Valiant, and the whole idea again, King Arthur type of thing.
Yeah.
And so he decided, oh, it would be neat to have a Valiant would be the name of the car.
Yeah, it stands out.
Yeah, it stands out, right. So they renamed the car Valiant, and Ford's compact car became the Falcon.
Oh.
Yeah,
yeah. Neat trade-off.
Yeah, it was a neat trade-off. Meanwhile, GM, of course, came out with the Corvair, and that was somewhat of a little bit of a downturn in the business that preceded, of course, the era, you might say, of the bean counter for the automobile industry. Not that it's been a bad thing; it's just that it was the Harvard Business School of Design became the way of the future for a good 10, 15 years. Really.
Of course, you know, the men who practice that have not been very visionary designers.
Well, of course, that hurts art to a great extent in all ages of history. Nevertheless, that was the future for Detroit, and it needed some of that too. Some accountants, and of course, then at that time, it was felt that the Chrysler, in particular, when Lynn Townsend came in, he wanted to overall kind of clean house to a great extent, you might say, and,
mm-hmm.
and get Chrysler a new image, and because they'd gone through the Newburgh business, and he was responsible, given the responsibility of cleaning up the act overall, and even to the extent of more or less moving my father aside and bringing in Elwood Engel
to
take his place. This was
Lynn Townsend?
Lynn Townsend, yes.
Yeah.
And my father still had, they still kept him on as a consultant, and this happened in 1962.
How was his health in 62?
It wasn't the greatest. Again, he'd always been struggling with his health besides, but he recovered quite strongly for a while, and as I had said before, he started to keep more in touch with his fine art to a certain
mm-hmm.
extent,
yeah.
And taking more time away from the pressure of the actual everyday involvement with Chrysler Design, but nevertheless, he was getting by this time in 1962, he was and he's 53 years old or so. He was getting close to where he could genuinely retire, and the family was urging him to take it easier because of his health and whatnot. But when Chrysler came along and said, okay, look, we want to bring in some new blood and whatnot, and then they brought in Elwood Engle from Ford, and my father stayed on as a consultant until he did officially retire at 55 from Chrysler.
So how many years
in 1964. Well, he'd really only been there for 13, 14 years.
14 years.
Yeah. So he moved aside, still continued to work on several projects with him and consulted with Engle and his group. But Engle revised the styling section and kept a great many of the people of whatnot, but that my father had built up. But then basically by this time, my own career was taking place or was starting to take place, you might say, and I was getting out of the service about that time. And it was a great opportunity for a dream that we'd always had together, and that is to go into business together.
So.